Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Today we're talking music from guitar masters to Norwegian pop. We've a trio of artists with albums out this week to discuss, and our expert on the matter is music critic Laura Snapes. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us, as ever. Let's start with a set of reissued albums by the late American guitarist Jack Rose, who sadly died at the age of just 38 back in 2009. Before we get into the specifics of the records, I guess, Laura, tell us a bit about Jack Rose. You know, who was Jack Rose is the opening question, I guess.
Well, Jack Rose started out in the 90s as a member of a band called Pelt, which was kind of more droney, noise kind of things. And then towards the end of that band, he swapped electric guitar for acoustic guitar. And then eventually, I think he left Pelt altogether. The story goes that he was working in a coffee shop in this farmer's market in Philadelphia. And one day he refused to give a free cup of coffee to a policeman, so he got fired. And so instead of trying to find another job, he just took the excuse to sit at home and just woodshed his guitar playing, just fully teach himself exactly everything he wanted. And he came out with this really interesting blend of like John Fahey, American primitivism, like raga, like Indian classical music, ragtime, this really, really incredible kind of energetic, forceful, just acoustic guitar playing, sometimes six string, sometimes 12 string. But the force of his playing, and by all accounts, the force of his personality, was really, really strong and came through in everything he did.
You've got to have a strong personality if you say no to a cop who wants a free coffee in a coffee shop, as I understand it. Tell us why now, then. What's with the re-release of these three records? What's the idea? What's the significance, other than being, you know, these amazing pieces of work by someone who's no longer with us?
I don't know if there was kind of a specific reason. Like, it's certainly not like any big anniversary of his death or anything, because there's the three reissues coming through three lobed records, and then there's another three, they were a week apart, through VHF records. And I don't really know why they chose to do them at the moment, but I suppose one thing that's really interesting, I've been writing about and researching this a little bit, Jack Rose, you know, Jack Rose was acclaimed during his lifetime in kind of an underground way, but in the years that have elapsed since then, his influence, I think, has really made itself known. You know, there's a generation of younger guitar players who were exposed to him at a young age, or who met him or were encouraged by him, and that kind of spurred them on into their careers. Like Steve Gunn, who's now signed to Matador, he was really influenced by him. This fantastic guitarist called Chris Forsyth. There's this whole generation of, when you talk to them, they all cite Jack Rose, even if they're not doing exactly what he did. Like Steve Gunn was saying that when Jack Rose passed away, this whole group of musicians were like, okay, well, we've got to work harder and more, and we've got to continue what Jack started. So maybe that was why.
Pretty amazing, inspirational figure. Let's hear a bit of a track from one of the records. This is from Dr. Ragtime and his pals, and the track is called Bells. Virtuoso stylings of Jack Rose. Lovely stuff. That's Bells from Dr. Ragtime and his pals. Tell us a bit about the record, the re-releases themselves. You mentioned there's three on VHF records, three lobed recordings also doing these reissues. Are they doing anything special? Are they kind of marking the occasion? What do we know? Are they special? You know, is there new artwork? All that kind of thing.
I don't think there's any new artwork. I think it's probably just the first time that all of these records have been in print on vinyl at the same time. Because certainly, you know, something like Dr. Ragtime and his pals, I think that had several existences as like a CD before it was ever a proper record. So yeah, they've all got the proper artwork, nicely kind of packaged. It's not one of those things, you know, sometimes with reissues where it's a bit exploitative, where it's like, oh, we've put it in a fancy box and we've put
fans
in some...
will have to buy this as well. Yeah.
We've put in some tat that nobody really needs. It's not like that. It's just the pure recordings on really beautiful vinyl in nice packages.
And you mentioned that you've been sort of kind of researching and writing around this as well. What's been the fruits of your particular labour? Is this a big piece that if people are interested, they can read more about, you know, that you've written and so on?
I did two pieces. There's one which is out on NPR just now, which is a lot of the people who Jack played with and was influenced by, but also who he influenced, talking about, they each pick a song from one of these reissued records and then use it as like the jumping off point to talk about him. So that's on NPR. And then on The Guardian from a couple of months ago, I wrote a piece on the new Cosmic Americana, and that was where I kind of realised how many people were citing Jack as an influence. So it starts by talking about him, Steve Gunn and Chris Forsyth mentioning his name.
I guess just finally, Laura, it is interesting. I mean, you mentioned that you know, certainly Jack Rice had quite an influence during his lifetime, but it was maybe a bit more underground. It was amongst these particular, you know, cliques, particular performers who were struck by him. Do you think with the re-release of the records, you know, and it inevitably does prompt people to look again, I guess, at someone's whole career, where do you think he'll be, I don't know, judged? Will he be in the pantheon of the greats? Do you think it will change over time? It's always interesting to see how whether someone's legacy evolves as their playing career did while they were alive, I guess.
Well, I suppose with somebody like him, you know, in popular culture, acoustic guitar players, like complex acoustic guitar, there's not really figures that particularly held up. You know, obviously John Fahey is really massive, and people like Robbie Basho, but they're not household names by any like extent. You know, it's not Dylan or anything like that. But I think within that community, he's incredibly respected, and hopefully, so some of the people that I was interviewing kind of around him, there's this guy called Glenn Jones, who probably at the time of them touring together was twice Jack's age, you know, in his 60s when Jack was in his 30s. And he was saying that meeting Jack kind of spurred him on to take his own career more seriously and kind of, you know, kicked him up the bum at a time where he might have relaxed. And he was saying that when they would go out and play these shows, there'd be loads of young people there who were saying to Jack Rose, "What Fahey should I listen to? I don't know any of this." So I think his legacy is as much an entry point as kind of the start of, you know, his own kind of career.
And that's a pretty good place to be. You can pick up the reissued versions of I Do Play Rock and Roll, Dr. Ragtime and His Pals, and the self-titled album, and now they're out on Three Load Recordings. Let's go to San Francisco's Tim Presley. Listeners might know him better as White Fence, or as one of the many past members of The Fall. He's collaborated too with Kate Le Bon last year under the moniker Drinks, and has been in various other bands and collaborations too. But Laura, tell us about this. Why release music now, you know, under his actual name, given all these various iterations we've seen and heard before?
Well, White Fence are really, really established. They've got endless records. I think six probably proper ones, but then probably tons and tons of collaborative and live ones as well. This is also kind of a collaboration with Kate Le Bon. It's not under the name Drinks, but she's produced this album for him. And I reckon that he's probably done it under his own name because it is very different from White Fence. The thing with White Fence is that it's like kind of got that pastoral, psychedelic kind of classicism to it. Like over the course of their six records, it's got cleaner and more kind of definably pop, kind of California sunshine. Whereas I think what he started with Kate Le Bon as Drinks and what came out a bit on her record, Crab Day, that came out earlier this year, is dirtier. It's more like this damaged art rock. It's like really fizzing and erratic and a bit atonal and dissonant. And so I suppose he wanted to make the differentiation so that White Fence fans probably weren't shocked by it. It is a really clean sounding record, but in a totally different way. Like where White Fence is kind of like sunshine and hay bales and stuff, this record is spikes and wires and brambles. But there's some hooks in there as well.
Well, let's take a listen. The time is right. This is from the new album The Wink, and it's called Clue. Another day, high flyer, low, Siri makes skin tire, pain louder, there is no pain louder than today's experienced person, bodyguard disappeared. That's Clue from the new album The Wink from Tim Presley. Now, you mentioned that Kate Le Bon produces this album as well, and you talked about some of the kind of changes through these different iterations of his performance. Can you sort of hear the influence very clearly still, though, of her on this record, do you think?
I think so much so that this American man is singing in like a Welsh accent. I think you can totally tell that she was in charge and that he was like this willing supplicant, which is great, you know, because he's got so many projects going on, he can do whatever he wants all the time. And I think to hear him doing this is really cool. But yeah, her influence is massively there. I know that she's been really influenced by this it's a soul jazz compilation, I think, called Punk 45, which is all these like weird, obscure kind of post-punk singles. And that stubbornness of that sound, I think, really comes through in this.
What kind of a performer is it that can move through these different guises with such ease? Because, you know, I guess we're used now, you know, in terms of collaborations, you know, so many musicians, in fact, some of them only really work that way. Others tend, you know, very set in their ways. Clearly, you've already described how you can sort of distinguish between the different sounds of some of the different things. But, you know, what makes somebody able to carry off that kind of chameleon game of dipping from one to another? What is it in his sort of musical makeup that means that it works?
Well, I guess one of the reasons that it works for him is that although White Fence are pretty established, they're still quite under the radar. You know, when a big act comes along and they're changing what they do all the time, it's seen as like the new era, the new period of like whatever they're doing. Whereas I think when you're doing something much more low stakes, like Tim Presley, and you're on a label like Drag City, they seem very open to letting people tool around and do whatever they want to do because they know that there's like a hardcore audience there who will like it.
Mm. Well, that's The Wink by Tim Presley. It's out now on Drag City Records. Let's finish the show, shall we, Laura, by looking ahead to one of this week's releases. Jenny, is it Hval?
Val, I think.
Forgive me. Jenny Val is a Norwegian musician who's just about to unleash her fourth album under her own name to the world. The record's called Blood Bitch, and we'll listen to a track first up. This is the current single called Conceptual Romance. Conceptual. That's Conceptual Romance. Laura, we've had two tracks from the album. That one, Female Vampire as well. Mm-hmm. What's in store on the rest of the record?
Well, it's been sold at, Blood Bitch has been sold as a record that kind of ties together themes of vampirism and menstruation, which, you know, they're very grabby kind of themes.
The classic musical tropes,
yeah, exactly.
Aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure you'll be getting that from the new Liam Gallagher album.
You never know.
Maybe. And so it's an interesting way to sell it, and there's definitely, there are parts where those themes come out really prominently, you know, there's definite songs on there that are very much about periods and about vampires, but it's not some kind of like schlocky concept album. It's, her last album, Apocalypse Girl, was incredible, but on that album she was kind of more, almost like giving sermons, not so much sermons, but kind of her judgment on various things was very obvious. She was, you know, being very opinionated within that album. And I was interviewing her last week, and she was saying with this one, she wanted to kind of sink into the music a little bit more. So a song like Conceptual Romance that we've just heard is kind of, it's not about like a relationship. It's kind of more about her relationship with her own music. And it's also really inspired by the Chris Krause book, I Love Dick, which has just been made into an Amazon pilot. So yeah, I think she was saying that it's a much more personal record. It's kind of like very dense with references. She watched a lot of really dodgy 70s horror films for it. So there's endless fathoms of it that you could dive into, really. You can take it at whatever level you want to.
So kind of blackly, I mean, and blackly comic, is there a sort of a wit, do you think, to her work? And also, I mean, in the same way, I wonder what she's like to watch performing. Is it, I mean, it's clearly going to be entertaining. Is it fun? Is it funny? How would you sum her up, do you think?
So I saw her properly live for the first time last week in Oslo, the day before I interviewed her, and it was the Norwegian premiere, like live premiere of her new album. And she has these dancers, and they are wearing capes, and they do fundamentally bad dancing, but just kind of fun, twirling around, waving their arms around. And in the back of the performance, there was like a, what looked like a tea party for a kid's birthday party, with like bowls of jelly and rosé in glasses with straws and half watermelons and stuff. Halfway through the gig, no warning whatsoever, the music stops and they just go and sit at this table and have a little tea party for 5 minutes.
Right.
And I think Norwegian audiences are quite polite, so everybody was kind of trying to figure out if they could laugh or not. It was really, really funny. And then after that, the kind of the table got a bit like destroyed, and there was watermelon being mashed everywhere, and there was confetti. I don't think I've ever been to such a sweet smelling gig. But yeah, there's obvious humour in what she's doing. I think the humour comes out probably more on Apocalypse Girl than on this one. But there's, if you approach it in the right manner, I think there are really, really funny parts of it.
So is it you already alluded to this, is it a concept album then, or is that an unhelpful label to throw around these days, do you think?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's conceptual in that, like, you know, she set out certain terms and she's working within certain boundaries. But I still think that when you say concept album, people imagine these like big sprawling 70s cock rocking kind of things, and I think what she does is literally the inverse of cock rock. But there is an interesting narrative you can follow through it if you want to. There's a part where, really towards the start of the album, where she's saying, like, come with me and I'll show you the original wound. And then from there, she kind of delves into all these themes about, like, pain and femininity and stuff. So there are threads running through it, but there's no one right way to read it. I think with Apocalypse Girl, she coined this term in the lyrics on that album, soft dick rock. And all of the interviews and all of the press around it was about this term, soft dick rock, and trying to distill the album down to a single ideology. And I think with this album, she really didn't want that. So it's kind of more like a constellation that you can get lost in, and you can like dot the stars together however you want. But there's loads of readings possible. But that all sounds highly theoretical, and like you have to get really involved. It's just a brilliant album to listen to. That Conceptual Romance song, I think, is really, really beautiful. There's a couple of difficult bits. Like, there's a song called The Plague, which is just like sound art and shrieking. But the rest of it is eminently listenable. compared to what you might think from the way I've just described it.
Indeed. Okay. And maybe that is out of the three. Maybe record of the week, that one.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's not out for a couple of weeks, but that's definitely my favourite one, I think.
Good stuff. Well, that's Blood Bitch by Jenny Vahl. It's out maybe on Friday on Sacred Bones. Definitely one to watch out for. And that brings us to the end of the show. Laura Snopes, thanks very much for being with us, as always. This is the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Our producer was Holly Fisher, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Do join us at the same time tomorrow. We'll be talking television. But for now, thank you for listening. Goodbye.